I don't like stuff that sucks.
You talking to me?
I love this radio station.
You talking to me?
Well, unless I am mistaken, we've actually run about 90 seconds short there with the material set up for a time slot. So, sorry, give me a moment while I put on my headphones and prepare and tell you that the program you were listening to was on recording. And we are now at this point live over WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. I can't speak for you, but I would have to say, yeah, if they're doing a report to the listener, they're calling it report with the listener, report to the listener tomorrow morning at 10 a.m., I would say tune in. Because the stuff that's going on here, as we tell you, during the fundraising drives, this being one of the first weeks where we're not doing it, is true. We need you. There are transitions. Obviously, this place is changing. And it is on Report to the Listener that you will find out about more of that. So do stay tuned. Do support the station. And here we go. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a sometimes weekly program on science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, our guest will be my favorite guest, actually. Sort of like my comfort food guest I'm meeting this morning, Richard.
of the Wolf movie review, air date June 12th, 2014, Edge of Tomorrow, take one.
June 12th, he thinks, huh?
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Edge of Tomorrow may be the least existential meditation on humanity's relationship to time ever. Really, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure is deeper than this. That's okay. It's a clever idea, cleverly executed. I just don't want anyone to be mistaken that there's anything more. There isn't. The setup is an action film revisioning of Groundhog Day. Tom Cruise is a military PR person who, thanks to his own craven cowardice, winds up dying on the front lines of a disastrous attack against an insurmountable alien army, and then being reincarnated only to fight the same battle over and over. The big difference is that in Groundhog Day, Bill Murray plays his typical self-centered tool who, in the course of repeating the same day, becomes a better human being, while Tom Cruise plays a self-centered tool who, in the course of repeating the same day, becomes the typical Tom Cruise action hero. The intent may have been to have some deconstruction of the iconic Cruise persona in the process, but since the actor tried to do something similar in Night and Day and failed disastrously, it's understandable that any such commentary would be seriously downplayed. But it's that distinction that marks the difference between a popular entertainment with enough emotional depth to turn it into a minor classic, and a popular entertainment that's fun enough in the watching, but that will likely be forgotten with whatever gets released the week following. But for all that, the film is fun enough. The trick with this kind of setup is to work enough variations on the theme that the inherent repetitiveness doesn't become wearing. And director Doug Liman brings a whole set of narrative tools to the party that make that work. He's especially clever in the ways he's found to suggest that more iterations occur than we actually observe, going all the way from the general structure of the film and how the initial conceit eventually branches off into Cruise recruiting the aid of Emily Blunt as a super soldier, all the way down to slyly inserted tip-offs in the dialogue. Cruise is such a pro at this that he tosses off his role through all its incarnations with typical and enjoyable ease, although not surprisingly, the more he evolves into the action hero, the less interesting he becomes. While Blunt plays well off Cruise, both as action hero and in the comedic moments as well. And special credit has to be given to Bill Paxton, who plays the sergeant in charge of Cruise's platoon and who has to play numerous permutations of confusion and surprise as Cruise's character repeatedly trumps his shtick. It's a nice little bit in a film that actually is chock full of amusing character performances. So as I said, Edge of Tomorrow is entertaining enough, even if some of the sequences play just a tad too long. Minor quibble, still fun. But if you prefer seeing the time-space continuum explored with a bit more teeth, there's a film coming up in the next couple of weeks that's considerably more interesting. It's called Coherence, and hopefully we'll be able to give it a look next week or the week following, so hang on for that. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at CineFantastique Online. Check out what you missed by going to cfqonline.com. Hour of the Wolf movie review, air date June 19th, 2014, How to Train Your Dragon 2, take one. I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. There seem to be some people who think that it's a film critic's dearest wish for a film to be bad, that we're on some kind of power trip, and every time a flaw crops up while we're watching, we do a little mental happy dance because it gives us a chance to fling our vitriol one more time. This is frankly BS. Who the hell wants to be stuck for 2 hours watching a bad film? Not me. Something of the opposite does occur, though, I think. You go into a film really wanting it to succeed and will twist your brain into pretzels trying to convince yourself that what you're seeing is better than it actually is. At some point, though, the preponderance of evidence builds to a level that you have to concede the battle and admit failure. That's never a pleasant feeling. That was my experience with How to Train Your Dragon 2. The original How to Train Your Dragon, released in 2010, is a fantastic film, one of DreamWorks' best, if not their best. It combined superlative animation and character design with an engaging story that was peppered with lots of cleverly staged set pieces. Coming from their work on Lilo and Stitch, directors Dean DeBlois and Chris Sanders took their skill at creating creatures that can be fearsome, yet appealing, and put it all into the combined feline and avian behaviors of Toothless, the dragon that allows the young Viking Hiccup to demonstrate to his village that the flying, flame-spewing lizards they've been battling for generations are more than just deadly predators. And the film was beautiful, a rare deployment of 3D filmmaking that used the process for more than just cheap thrills. The beauty is still there in How to Train Your Dragon 2. Dean DeBlois, now scripting and directing on his own, fills the screen with stunning imagery, incredibly convincing character performances, and a veritable swarm of dragons in all their variety and glory. There's rarely a moment when the visuals aren't ravishing, and the 3D is still a textbook example of how to use the technology for dramatic impact. But the storytelling is a mess. In many ways, the failures here parallel the failures of The Amazing Spider-Man 2. In one way, it exactly parallels Spider-Man's failure. But since that involves a plot spoiler that's horrendously handled in both films, I can't talk about it here. Those of you who have seen Spider-Man will probably know what I'm talking about. But from a more general point of view, there's just too much stuff thrown into the hopper without any apparent thought to forming it into a single compelling narrative. There's a warlord with a dragon army, an amoral pirate with a thriving business in dragon wrangling, our hero Hiccup's reunion with his long-absent mother, now a kind of Diane Fossey of the dragons, a fiercely bemasked warrior Diane Fossey, plus all the supplementary, mostly comic relief characters to deal with. The dialogue is cliché-ridden and clunky. Key characters drop out of focus, only to return when somebody apparently remembers we haven't been seeing what they've been doing for a while. And while there are some genuinely affecting moments here, there are others that just fall flat. You find yourself overall not caring about the stakes involved. And still, I hesitate to dismiss the film completely. It is an incredible work of animation art, which distinguishes what DeBlois is doing from director Mark Webb's indifferent approach to his Spider-Man films. DeBlois may have blown the storytelling aspect, but visually, there's a lot to feast on here. Doesn't quite mean that How to Train Your Dragon 2 clears the bar as a satisfying film-going experience. It's essentially a failure, and that gives me no pleasure to say. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at CineFantastique Online. Check out what you missed by going to cfqonline.com.
Thank you, Dan, and my apologies. Whoa, okay, why are we... This thing is on repeat? No, we don't have to start the show over again. We've already done that. But, good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. And as mentioned earlier, this is a weekly program of squeaking microphones, science fiction, and fantasy. And, I don't know if I offended. I think I got eye-rolling, at least, from this morning's guest when I said, you know, the comfort food guest. Because he's anything but comfortable in terms of his fiction. He's rather edgy. Richard Bowes.
Right, who's the vanilla pudding, apparently, of on-air guests.
But you see, it's not that you're vanilla pudding. It's that I know that however bad I'm feeling, whatever it is that I am doing, I'm going to have an excellent show without any effort on my part.
My goodness gracious. You mean I'm doing all the work?
Yep, you're doing the heavy lifting here.
My entire life really has been devoted to not doing anything. I've probably managed to live for 70 years doing less work than anybody who has lived for 70 years.
Well, you're a writer.
I'm a writer.
And tell us, you know, there are people who've not heard you on this program before. I have no idea how many times you've been on at this point.
173 times.
I knew you'd know that number.
No, it's not that.
I wouldn't be shocked if it was nearing 20.
Oh, I think it's more than that.
Yeah, I think so, too.
I think it's more than that. I've been on the show for almost 20 years.
And, yeah. And sometimes solo and sometimes with groups.
Ensemble. Well, what groups have I ever been? I've been on with Chris Barzak, but I don't...
Have you not yet... No, you've been on at least once with Altered Fluid.
Oh.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I wasn't there.
You weren't at the radio station. I went to a law office.
Oh, that's right. Yes, it was David Rivera's law office.
I was trying not to say that. Why? Well, he doesn't work there anymore.
He doesn't work there anymore. He works for somebody else.
He works for people I used to work for.
Right, but
in a building that I helped design the infrastructure for.
Yes, David is the nicest person in the world. Let's not.
And a good writer with two good books out.
Yes. An excellent short story.
Exactly. Yeah.
Poor devil. Because there's nothing more forlorn than being a short story writer, as I will tell you.
Yeah, Although you have managed, you've mastered
the art of turning short stories into fix-up novels. Yes.
Yes. Or you used to use a term that I still like a great deal, that I think is a little kinder than fix-up, which is the mosaic novel.
That was a thing invented by Jeff Vandermeer, who then abandoned it he doesn't recognize that anymore.
Well, I don't care if he recognizes it. You used it, gave it to me, and I'm still using it. And that's not true of all of your books. Some of your books are, yes, sort of fix-ups where we have continuity that simply goes from story to story. But some of them, I mean, particularly Time Rangers from the give me the whole title from the...
From the Files of the Time Rangers. Well, that's a fix-up. That's nine stories.
Yes, except that when you read it very carefully, you will see the DNA tissue of another story within this one, that there will be more than just nodding references. It does turn out to be a novel.
It does. Well, so does Minions and so
Minions
does Dust
of the
Devil.
Moon.
Minions of the Moon
which
and
won
Dust
the
Devil.
Lambda Award.
Dust Devil on a Quiet Street, which was nominated for a Lambda Award.
Currently, both of these books are currently in print.
That's right. Both of those books are currently in print, and as a matter of fact, from the Files of the Time Rangers can be obtained without very much difficulty.
Oh, can it? I'm glad to hear that because I love
then
that.
Then I go honest, and I have four short story collections in which there's no attempt at all to...
Oh, piffle. Who cares about honesty? There's the fairy tale book, which I adore.
I love the fairy tale book also. The Queen, the Cambion, and Seven Others. And it's very short, which fairy tale books should be. And it has illustrations, which
fairy tale books
should have.
Yeah.
And so it has the two main things. And it has an essay by me on small books.
I would like an essay from you. I can do it before the show is over. I would be interested in some point, and we have discussed this a little on the air, but I would like to hear, like, you and maybe Theodora Goss and a couple of other people in that field discussing the non-Bruto Bettelheim recognition of the importance of fairy tales.
Well, it's a genre in and of itself. I mean, one of the reasons that I began to get it, one of the things that made me interested in fairy tales was the work of a woman, a Picard, Léonie Picard.
Yeah, you told us a little bit.
Yeah, who was a British, Barbara Léonie Picard, and she was a British writer of children's books. And in the late 1940s and early 1950s, she brought out a series of fairy tale collections, which I glommed onto and read. And that is the reason I brought out The Queen, The Cambion, and seven others. But yeah, I've done short story collections. I did at the very beginning of my career. I did actual real science fiction novels. War Child and Goblin Market.
Right. That's
Goblin
right.
Market.
I like Goblin Market.
You and Cage Baker, you know, I was very sick. I had written War Child, and I sold that. And at the time that that happened, I had cancer. And I fortunately recovered from it. But I then wrote, you'd be surprised how fast you can write a book if you have cancer. The next book I wrote was...
Kids, don't try this at home.
Well, don't try this at home, no. But Feral Cell is a book about somebody who's me, basically, and who has... It's some years in the future, although it's now well in our past, and it's New York, and it's a very gamey New York, and this guy has... This land, which is cancer, and then there's the magic kingdom of Capricorn, in which you can go and you will not die of your cancer if you can stay in Capricorn. But if you come from this world to Capricorn, you are hunted for your skin. They skin you. It's a disgusting story. But anyway, but boy, did I write it fast, because I thought, oh my God, I'll die before it's finished. And then the third book, I was really very tired, and I just wrote this thing because I had to write it, and I thought it was quite dreadful, and Cage Baker, bless her, wanted to read those early books, and I sent them off to her, and I said, and the third one is Goblin Market, that's the sequel to War Child, and it's really not very good. And she read the books, and she said, you're wrong, Goblin Market is quite good. The ending is bad, but the book itself is quite good. And I read the book on her recommendation. And you know, it was quite good, and I didn't remember having written it. So that it all came as a complete surprise to me. And it was really the most enjoyable read of my own book that I've ever had.
Really?
Yeah, it was really...
I liked it. I liked it.
You really have
lot.
To be completely screwed up in order to get this kind of thrill, but, you know...
No, I don't think so. I really don't think so. I don't... I find a lot of the people say, oh, I can't watch my movies, I can't read my books, or anything like that. Delaney constantly rereads his stuff, and even worse, he's always re-editing it. I mean, I've actually had him reading a story on the air out from...
A classic
short story or piece of a novel. He was he's reading a piece from the Einstein Intersection.
Right, and he decided to change it.
And during the reading, he takes out a pencil. During the reading, live on the air. I mean, you've got to love that.
Right, or not. But
I do.
Both Minions of the Moon and Dust Devil in a Quiet Street, which are really semi-autobiographical stories, novels made up of stories, have come out on audio. And I just listened to Minions of the Moon.
Who read them?
I am going to be very bad. I'm not going to be able to remember the actors' names. The one who did Minions of the Moon is quite good. He sounds very much like me. And what could be better than that, really? I listened to this thing. I limited myself to, like, you know, an hour a night, and I read it over a period of like a week and a half. And it was great. I just so thoroughly enjoyed it. It wasn't as good as reading Goblin Market, because I did remember the plot, too.
By the way, speaking of narrators,
yes.
As they call them now, instead of readers,
yes,
I should just mention that next week on this program, our guest will be Kate Baker.
Yes.
Of Clark's
narrator. Movies. Narrator extraordinaire.
She is one. She is one.
Yeah, she's superb.
I work with others as well. She works for Clark's World. I work for Lightspeed Magazine. I'm the host.
That's right. It's like the
I work with
Montagues and the Capulets.
God. I mean, as a matter of fact, this last month during the Women Destroy Science Fiction Month, we rebroadcast Kate Baker reading a story that had originally rebroadcast. It's a podcast. We repotted, there's a new word, a story that Kate did. That, you know, this is not If you listen to one, you ought to listen to the other. And she does a great, great job, and she'll be here next week. I just thought I'd mention that.
That is nice.
But the people I work with, Kate is a narrator and a host.
Yep.
I am a host, but I'm working with actors. I'm working with Stefan Rudnicki and Gabrielle DeCure, who got the Audi Award this year.
Yes, I know. Who could, yes.
We held an event for them, and 8 people showed up.
Yes, I...
You heard about that one.
Yes, I wasn't one of those 8 people, I'm sorry to say.
Yeah. You're at most of our events. You showed up for the next one, didn't you? The one 3 days later?
3 days later, yes. Yeah. Well, this morning I would like to, if it's possible, I would like to read parts, anyway, of a story I wrote for a magazine called The Revelator, which is put out by Eric Schaller, and, oh my goodness.
That guy from Maine.
That guy from Maine, yes, what is his name?
Oh, God, I'm...
The Mumpsimus. Oh, God, I can't remember his name, and this awful, he's probably...
Wonderful
something.
Interviewer and essayist,
and a very, very good writer, and I can't
Matt
remember...
Matt Chaney,
thank you.
Matthew Chaney.
Matt Chaney, yes, Vice President Chaney's son, yes, I've forgotten.
C-H-E-N-E-Y, he spells it differently than the VP thing.
He changed it because he was so ashamed.
You blame him?
I can't blame him at all, no. Anyway, this is an online magazine, and it looks like this fusty old thing that's been around for 100 years, but actually it's a fusty old thing that's only been around for a few years.
About 2, I think.
Yeah, a couple of years, yes.
Yeah.
Although it is fusty, and which I consider a compliment. And I wrote for them this story, Stories I Tell to Friends, and I would like to read at least the opening part of it right now. Stories I Tell to Friends. Lois and I have a brother-sister relationship. We agree that Lois is the brother. And after a long friendship, we both feel we know all about each other. So one day, last fall, she says, "As a kid, I had a crush on Captain Kangaroo. It was the mustache and the uniform. And I'm not surprised. Between the reign of Howdy Doody and the rise of Sesame Street, the captain was the idol of small kids. He appeared when I was maybe 12 and too old for his charms. In fact, he seemed pretty stupid with his singing puppets and all. Lois is 6 years younger and obviously felt differently. Then she tells me, maybe around 1987, he and I got it on. I met him in a bar out on the Hamptons. The mustache wasn't the same, and he wasn't dressed as the captain, which was disappointing. But I imagined him wearing the uniform. He could still do the voice, and I made him call me Mr. Green Jeans, like that guy on the show. He was staying in someone's guest house that weekend, and it was in no way great. The kick came when I told my youngest sister, who's still sentimental about him, what had happened. Then Lois said, I figured you'd know how it is with uniforms. There was that cop boyfriend and that sexy West Indian guard. This bothers me. I actually love those guys, up to a point. Also, I realized childhood and fitting in has been on my mind, so I say, my time with uniforms was when I was little, fireman first, then cops. She's interested, and I tell her this story. My earliest memory of uniforms is from when I was maybe 3 or 4. My mother was this disenchanted actress, and my father was a young World War II vet. We were living in Jamaica Plain, in Boston, in Fordham Court, an old horseshoe-shaped apartment house on South Street. One night, I awoke, and my mother was taking my pajamas off and putting me in clothes. A fire had broken out a bit further down the horseshoe, and everyone was being evacuated. A young fireman came in, huge in his hat and boots and coat, and looking very serious. He lifted me up, climbed out a window, carried me down the fire escape, handed me back to my parents, said I was a great kid, and headed back up the stairs. The night was full of the sounds of breaking glass and the grinding noise of ladders rising. I watched the fireman, especially the one who had carried me. Because of him, I wasn't afraid. They put the fire out, but my mother and I were in a taxi headed for her mother's house over in Dorchester. We passed the Franklin Park Zoo, and up on the hill was the giraffe house, with the 2 giraffes out and their long necks outlined against the moon, like magic. And after that, when anyone asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up, I'd say a fireman, because of that amazing night. and everyone would smile and nod like they approved. A couple of years later, we were living in the D Street housing project in South Boston. Built for returning servicemen, the place was tough from the start. My parents weren't like the other blue-collar or no-collar people. I had a little brother now. My mother was not happy there. My father had been in the theater, too, and then the war. He was not happy in general. Maybe I was six, standing one day with other kids from the projects on the sidewalk on D Street. The kids and I weren't real close. I was too different. All of a sudden, this police car pulled up, and two cops got out. The kids were streetwise enough to back away and watch me get arrested. The cops were my Uncle Bill and one of my mother's brothers, and his partner, Casey. "We heard you wanted to be a fireman," my uncle said, and I nodded. He frowned his disapproval, as did Casey. "Now, why would you want to do that?" he asked. And I explained about burning houses and climbing up and down fire escapes, and all the flashing lights and wonderful noise they made roaring through the streets. Bill nodded, and Casey got into their car, turned on the siren and red lights on the roof. "Just as good as a fire engine," my uncle said, and I wanted to argue, but was intimidated. "Besides," my uncle told me, "firemen don't go home at night. They live in the station and have to cook their own meals because there's no one to do it for them." "And they don't get to carry weapons," said Casey, slipping his police special out of his holster for me to look at. The kids began to creep closer, fascinated. The gun was madly interesting, but mostly it was the thought of not living at home and having to learn to cook that swayed me. "Okay, I'll be a policeman," I said. And they rubbed my head, patted my back hard, and took me across the street for a double-scoop ice cream cone with chocolate jimmies. This could have been a spur-of-the-moment joke. They saw me and thought it would be funny, but my father and all five of my uncles served in the Army in World War II. Not a sailor in the family. It was never spelled out, but sailors became firemen. And in an Army family, the Navy was the enemy. Cops were soldiers. That was the right path, and I'd been set on it. "That's why you didn't like Captain Kangaroo," Lois said when I told her the story. We laughed, but our conversation sticks with me. Not the uniform, but the ways of that city I only visit now for funerals. It's still on my mind one snowy February day when an old lover, Georgie, is in New York and stops by. He and I smoke a bit and bounce in my bed a bit to remind ourselves of how we were. Due consideration has to be taken of my arthritis and his bad heart, and he says, "The only thing more depressing than an old man is two old men." We watch a movie I'd somehow never seen, Bugles Over Broadway, GIs and Hollywood Dames, Times Square, 1943. The sailors and soldiers, headed overseas to fight for their country, tend to be young, unknown actors, most of whom stayed unknown after the war. One singer sailor falls in love with a dancer. Spencer Tracy, the kindly priest at a little church around the corner, marries them. Women are the big stars, Merman and Grable, Davis and Bankhead, singing, dancing, sending the boys off with a tear and a song. My old love and I identify with the dames. Interspersed are novelty acts and walk-ons by comedians. In a simpler, crueler age, a cross-eyed comic who stutters tries to gain admittance to the USO Center, and Joan Blondell, guarding the door, asks, "Who sent you, the enemy?" Then a guy playing a drunk in a top hat and tails suddenly falls down a flight of stairs, and the words, "Rubberlegs McCoy," come out of me. I'm almost as surprised as Georgie. "A Pratt artist," I tell him, like this explains something, and he frowns his non-comprehension. The movie ends with the Stars and Stripes flying and couples dancing and saluting. Georgie asks, "How did you learn about Rubberlegs?" For a moment, I don't know. Then I remember, my father and a pal from his theater days talked about him when I was a kid. Georgie lays back, amused, waiting for more, and I tell him stuff I hadn't thought about in over 60 years. I was maybe 9, and we were living in a duplex apartment carved out of an old mansion in this tree-lined, hilly neighborhood, Ashmont in Dorchester. The front room was probably once a parlor. The curved windows had an antique blue tinge. Now it was mostly my father's office. He was president of the Boston Teachers Union, which was fighting for recognition. It's what he did when he wasn't teaching. Most of this I didn't understand, but he had a second phone in the office, which was a very big deal in 1953. The family TV was in that room, and I was watching it when my father and his friend Denny Fitzpatrick came in talking. Jack Durham is the best lighting tech in New England, said Denny. But he attended a couple of party meetings 20 years ago, and now he can't get work. Lee Falk takes the blacklist seriously. You look at the comic strips Falk does and know that the Phantom and Mandrake vote Republican. My father laughed. Back then, Boston was full of guys who wrote and drew the comic strips. I followed in the Globe and the Record American. These same guys also ran theaters. This didn't seem incredible to a kid. It's just how things were. Until right then, I didn't realize the Phantom was a Republican, which I knew was bad. My father said, Al Capp's in the same boat as Falk, and every single little Abner character is a good liberal Democrat. Capp's got no choice. If his theater hires anyone or books a show with anyone, cast or crew, who's on the list, he'll be smeared by Joe McCarthy. Denny said, someone gets shut out of a part because he was a kid pinko, and I get hired. Makes me feel bad. My father told him, you're the best character actor north of Broadway. Half listening to this, I watched Abbott, the fast-talking, conniving straight man, and Costello, the fat, confused, fool-of-God comic, argue with the landlord, a big, bald-headed guy in a sleeveless T-shirt. He won't let them back in their room because they owe something like $27 rent. Before whimsical characters like Captain Kangaroo, way before educational shows like Sesame Street, children were entertained by over-the-hill burlesque comedians. My father hated TV, except when he was watching it, and usually he yelled at me for being indoors instead of outside playing. But he and Denny were quiet, and I knew they were watching, too. The set was a block of walk-up apartments that I understood was supposed to be New York. Ah, Denny murmured, it's a gray and desperate world they inhabit. Confused and angered by Abbott's double talk, the landlord made sputtering sounds. A flubber, said Denny. The landlord slapped his forehead. A one-palm smack, he said. The landlord slapped his forehead with both hands, then dragged them down his face. A double palma and a slow burn, Denny remarked. This man knows his business, whoever he is. Every routine, every gag, any vaudeville clown ever invented, these two steal every Saturday morning, said my father. Then he told me, get your fat head out of the way. Denny, right behind me, patted my shoulder, like it was okay with him that I was there. He and his wife had no children, so he actually liked kids. Denny went on to have a fine career hosting local children's TV shows. The phone rang, and my father picked it up, listened, and said, next Tuesday night. Central Labor Council. We need a turnout. Calls like this always came in on the special phone. Sometimes the TV sound had to be turned off. My little brothers and sisters and I had to be quiet while our father talked. Sometimes he got real happy or very mad. This time it was just him saying mysterious adult stuff I didn't understand. Then, on screen, Stinky the spoiled brat appeared, and I watched in horror. He was a fat grown-up, dressed in velvet short pants and jacket, wearing a straw hat with a ribbon, and carrying an enormous lollipop. Super sissy. He sprayed saliva when he talked, cried, jumped up and down when he didn't get his way. Though he appeared almost every week, I always managed to forget about Stinky. The invisible audience laughed, but I found him scary. Even at 9, I sometimes had to wear shorts and wondered if I'd end up like him. Maybe that was written on my face. Maybe Denny had second sight. But like I understood, he said, I know him. He came through with the show when your father and I did summer stock. Off stage, he's okay. My father hung up after saying, I don't care. Everybody's got to turn out for this. Denny asked, remember Joe? And gestured towards the screen. He was in that Burt Lahr show. Lahr's big obsession was finding some property he could take on the road every summer. Remember him saying, I need to find something classy, like Hamden had, with that Sereno the Bergerac. I didn't know why, but they laughed, which was good. That and money, said my old man. Lahr loved to see it come in. He'd sit in the box office before a show, in makeup and out of sight of the customers. He'd count the dough, arrange the bills, and look on fondly as I put them in the safe. Georgie's eyes lit up when I mentioned my father and Lahr. Later, of course, we'd know him as the man who played the Cowardly Lion in The Wizard of Oz, but kids our age didn't know about the movie until it got shown on TV years later. When Georgie tried to ask questions, I shook my head, gestured for him to wait. I told him how Denny and my father cracked up, and I lost track of Abbott and Costello's problems. Some guy in a battered Silk Hat was coming down the front stairs when suddenly his legs turned to water and he fell flat on his face. Unlike the soundtrack audience, I didn't think this was funny. It was a weirdly compelling glimpse into the adult world. Rub-a-leg, said my father. He was in that La show, too. A true and versatile artist, said Denny. He could do the trip, the slip, and the pratfall, but that flat pan he just pulled was his masterpiece. Jimmy Rub-a-legs McCoy. He turned to me and asked, you want to go into show business? No, I'm going to be a policeman. Steady work, Denny said. I promised my Uncle Bill. Somehow, Rub-a-legs falling down the stairs seemed to have ended the show. My father noticed the credits rolling and said, okay, you've seen enough TV. Go out and play.
Great stuff. Really.
Why, thank you.
Now, this is all Boston?
This is all Boston. And there's more if I can read it later.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just mesmerized by this. But I'm, and so is that Jimmy McCoy? That was Rub-a-legs? I don't know him. I mean, because
because of...
Are these real names?
They're real people. They're not real names.
Got it. Okay.
And the blacklist thing is, I mean, why... That was a real thing.
Because I'm still watching...
My parents, by the way, were in the theater, and they worked for Al Capp, who ran a theater in Boston.
They really did.
And
wow.
I was introduced to Al Capp when I was like maybe 5 years old, and they said because he had a wooden leg.
Yeah.
And they did the thing. I was the first child, so they hadn't learned, you never do this. They said, he has a wooden leg, so don't stare at his leg. And of course, I stared fixedly at his leg. I mean, he was wearing pants, and I couldn't see the wooden leg, and I wanted desperately to see the wooden leg.
Yeah.
And I think He was very nice with kids. He was a very nice
guy. Bill Veeck, who owned...
right, they were common.
A number of baseball... but he'd wear a peg leg on certain days. Like on the 4th of July, he had a red, white, and blue peg leg.
And these things were not... I mean, I see guys in the gym now with, you know, the modern construction legs, and this stuff was torture. But anyway, Cap was there, and Lee Falk, who did The Phantom and Mandrake the Magician, also was in Boston. A lot of people who did comic strips for one reason or another.
It's interesting because I grew up in Queens in an apartment building where the guy who did Smokey Stover,
sure.
Lived. And I'm not sure, did he also do Barney Google or was that somebody else?
If he didn't, then somebody was stealing.
It's probably the same guy.
I think it's the same guy, but there were all kinds of the...
He was the nicest man.
Big Ben Bolt.
He would give me tennis balls.
Big Ben Bolt, which was a boxing thing. Big Ben Bolt was a boxer, and that's set in Boston, and because it's a realistic comic strip, I was looking at some old issues of Big Ben Bolt, and it's Boston streets from the 1950s. It's really very strange. Yeah, but there were a few. The guy who did Big Ben Bolt, he went on to do the Prince Valiant
script. Wow, okay.
So there were all of these guys there, but only Falk and Cap owned theaters. Falk was a Republican and Cap was a Democrat. They owned a theater together at one point, or ran a theater together.
Because in Cap's later years, he appeared to become reactionary.
He had reaction. Well, to be a leftist in the 30s and 40s was, if you didn't advance in any way, pretty conservative by the 60s.
I see.
And he was believed in representational art. He didn't believe in modern art. He didn't, and went on at length about this and became pretty bloody unamusing.
Yeah, exactly. I so loved all the various versions of Little Abner, including the rarely seen non-musical version with Buster Keaton as the Indian.
This is
something you can only show on late night TV because it's really politically... Well,
incorrect.
Let's put it this way.
Yeah, I've seen it.
The owner of the Washington football team would probably embrace it.
Well, I think he's probably running away from that at this point, but...
Well, he lost his copyright and trademark.
Right.
Thanks to WBAI's Suzanne Schoen.
The thing with this scene was Cap's younger brother did continuity and dialogue for a couple of... Cap had Long Sam. He had a few other comic strips. It was very... It was a very strange thing, but... and it was a very... The Boston theater world was a very strange, small world. I will use an actual name. My father's pal, Denny, was an actor named Richard Kilbride, who was a Boston actor. And
he did TV?
He did
his
a couple...
vaguely...
He did. He was on... He did a lot of TV. He did children's shows. I will not begin to describe them, because those are also not... fit for, but yeah, it was an odd Mr. Rouet's neighbor. But
yes.
the thing with the fireman carrying me down the ladder, and my father, we wanted to be a fireman, and then my uncle and his partner showing up and converting me, you know, saying, "Oh, no, you don't want to be a fireman," because they're Navy and Navy are the enemy. Just that actually, all of that is real. I mean, that's...
Well, we want to get back to your reading soon, but I'd like to ask you...
You need some water.
And I shall go fetch. But I wanted to ask you, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask you a question that you can then take a little time answering, and I'll go fetch you water in that time. And the question is, how did you get from wanting to be a fireman or this or that to the illustrious... profession where you are today? I mean, yes, you worked as a librarian at NYU.
I was a reference clerk.
Within the library at NYU. And when I use the word librarian, John
Klima...
You
use it the way everybody does that. Well, he's a librarian.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
How did I... That's in the story. You want me to tell how... No, I'd have to read the rest of...
You've been in a store long enough. Oh, God.
I hear that noise.
Slight
are we on the air? Are we on the air here?
Yeah, we're
on the air. I'll read some more of the story.
No. Don't read while I've got this door open. I'll just be 30 seconds. You fill that air time.
All I have to do... You know, when you're a little kid, you want... identify with firemen, policemen. I don't know if kids do anymore, but certainly they did when I was a child. The New York Fire Department headquarters building, it's no longer their headquarters, is on Great Jones Street. And there's this incredible inscription on the front of... It's still a functioning fire station, and they took very heavy casualties in 9/11. But it's the inscription is that these heroes, these riding through the streets with these teams of white horses pulling the fire engines, were the envy of every small boy. And I think that probably wasn't universally true, but I think these were admired figures. And that is also... I was Irish in Boston, and if you were Irish, you became a policeman.
Everybody's Irish in Boston.
It was a very high percentage of Irish in Boston. It wasn't as high as it seemed to be, which I thought everyone in the world was Irish, but there was a thing. My uncle was the granduncle was Liam O'Flaherty, who wrote The Informer, and as a kid I was sat down in front of the TV to watch the movie version of The Informer,
which of the great movies,
right, much better than the book. And
but no offense,
it seemed all of the young people were Hollywood actors and spoke with in American accents. All of the older people had been flown over from the Abbey and the... taken over from the boat, I don't know how they got there, from the Abbey and the Dublin Gate, and they were Irish, and they spoke with brogues. And this reflected life as I knew it, in which old people all had brogues, and young people were Americans. And I believed that as you got older, you developed a brogue and became, you know, that this was like the passage of time. It was that Irish a place... And this had, one of my brother David once said about the Irish in America, that they took the boot of oppression off their neck and put it on their foot. And there were certainly things that were not good about this. But and some of that I will get to here in the second part of the story, if I can do that.
Absolutely. And I'm going to cue up a song based on some of the things you've been saying, so to give us a brief break with after this portion.
But, okay, I'll read some a few more pages.
Please.
I knew better than to argue. As I left, my father told Denny, McCoy's another one who won't be working. It's amazing how many old hoofers, burlesque comics, even strippers, attended a meeting of the Young Communist League in 1936 and walked right onto some blacklist. Old teachers, even. It's baloney, but get too close to that, and no one wants to be near you. McCarthy, said Denny. After the places we'd lived, the duplex seemed huge and rich. The long hall was all dark wood and had a fireplace. There was one in the living room, too. I could hear my little brother and sisters talking, the beagle barking in the backyard. In the living room of our big and mysterious apartment was an Oz connection. By a bay window, under the stairs to the second floor, was an alcove, and in it was a player piano with a few old piano rolls. When I lay on the living room carpet, listening to the Lone Ranger on the radio, I could look under the piano and see what appeared to be a book. It was jammed in. Poking it with a broom did no good. I couldn't move the piano by myself, and no one was interested in helping. But at a big, noisy family party, for a birthday, maybe a christening, two of my mother's brothers, Bill the Cop, and Mike, who did stuff on the docks in South Boston, both great big guys, were there and quite smashed. I told them no one was able to move the piano, a challenge. They took one look and hauled it out of the corner as my cousins applauded. I dove for the book, which was big, green, and a bit warped. I opened it to a color illustration of a girl and a lion who was crying. Mesmerized, I sat on the stairs looking at the pictures. I had never heard of The Wizard of Oz. Later, I learned that the bomb books weren't approved of. Libraries in Boston didn't have them. My uncle shook their heads and pushed the piano back in place, maybe wondering about this nephew who Bill made promise to become a cop. When I was in my teens, The Wizard of Oz started getting shown on TV. My father pointed out the cowardly lion and repeated the story about Lars fondness for money and Sereno. The house where we lived by then, I remember as dark and miserable. I'd made some discoveries, and each pushed me a bit further from my father, my friends, my city. But honey, amidst the misery and despair, God had sent you a sign, said Georgie. The Wizard of Oz. I shake my head and we both laugh. The weather has cleared enough that we go out and eat. At the Thai restaurant, I start to remember another story, but I know it's not one Georgie would fully appreciate. I tell it to Joey a couple of weeks later when he comes to New York to visit his parents and me. We're friends of long standing. I love him, but he's straight, which I find kind of tragic. We sit in the old cafe on my street and joke about the time we spent a few bad nights in jail. Then I tell him my story. At the end of ninth grade, when I was 14, I flunked out of boys' Latin. Sex and trauma led to attention problems. Also, a lot of my teachers didn't like my old man and his attempt to unionize. Teachers were all male and considered themselves professionals, not laborers. One told me, sadly, your father and you have a lot in common. I was upset by this, but never told my old man. The high school my father found for me was nicknamed the Country Club, an easygoing kind of slack place. A lot of the teachers were women and loved my father because the union would give them the same salary as the men. My first few weeks there, I met a guy, Bobby Mahoney, who was a year ahead of me, more than a year older, bigger and tougher. We became friends. Bobby thought I was funny, had me as a sort of mascot at first. He and I lived several neighborhoods apart. His father and my father knew each other. Bobby's father was Big Bob Mahoney, chairman of the Boston Labor Board. He was the man you went to if it involved unions. I realized Big Bob didn't believe my father was the right union type, and I knew my father blamed Big Bob for not supporting the teachers' union, but neither ever said anything directly to me, and I made a point of not thinking about it. Since Mrs. Mahoney was always buying stuff, their house was kind of rich and nice. But it was also sort of a wreck because she took all kinds of pills and slept a lot. And Big Bob always lay on the furniture with his shoes off and his shirt open, dropping lighted cigarettes and booze on cushions and rugs. He drank a lot, but in Irish Boston, circa 1960, that pretty much went without saying. Mrs. Mahoney thought I was polite and wanted Bobby to behave like I did, which made him punch me in private. One Saturday, late in my junior year, his senior year, she was away or upstairs passed out. Like always, Bobby had lifted some of her Benzedrine, and it sang in our ears. We went through the living room. Big Bob was spread out on a couch, with a tall, full glass on the floor beside him, cigarette ashes everywhere, talking on the telephone. He hung up as we came in and asked where we were going. We said to see Ben-Hur. Actually, we planned to sneak into Suddenly Last Summer, a picture condemned by the Legion of Decency. Mahoney gave a look that made you think he'd read your every dirty secret. Nice life, he said. Wish I'd had it that way when I was your age. It wasn't like now, where you go to school and spend the rest of your time watching movies and TV. Things were tight, he curled his lip. Leisure was for the rich. People like us had to work. Bobby ground his teeth, stared away like I'd heard this many times. How's your father? Mahoney asked me. I said he was fine. Maybe they didn't get along, but my old man handed me much the same line as Mahoney. Both were raising their sons to be the people they hated when they were young. Mine said I had everything he'd wanted at my age. His father had died when he was 14 in the depths of the Depression. I went to college, you know, Big Bob said, took a swallow of whiskey, barely touched with water. It wasn't my grades got me in. I played high school football, receiver and defensive end back when you played the whole game. I got hit in the head a few times playing. Made me stupid. He smiled, but his eyes dared us to agree. He made a face like he tasted something sour. After a year or two, I got tossed out. Bad grades and bad circumstances. I couldn't see going home. This guy I met, Paletto, knew his way around sports. Suggested I try wrestling. It's all an act, he said. Like you're in a movie or something. And the dumbasses will bet on it. Jackie Paletto was a sportsman, said the voice behind us. I introduced you to him. I turned. Bobby called his Uncle Frank, the family muscle. Frank Mahoney was wider than Big Bob, who seemed kind of refined next to him. My older brother, Bob raised a glass. He came down to Pennsylvania to see me. He and Paletto started poker games on campus, helped to get me thrown out. Your ass was already halfway out the door, Frank walked over to the bottle, found a glass, and poured. So I took Mr. Paletto's advice, and I went to New York, said Big Bob. In this office, right near Madison Square Garden, I tell them about me and football, and they like the idea that I'm this all-American type kid. And that's it. They set me up on this tour. There were half a dozen of us going on a bus from town to town. No helmet or cleats in the ring, but they put me in a letter jersey and warm-up pants, all red, white, and blue. We'd stay in these lousy little hotels and eat at diners, but we got paid. There was a guy supposed to be a cowboy with a big hat and lasso. He'd hog-tie opponents, which the referee somehow never saw. I'm in the ring with this guy from Hawaii, supposed to be a sumo wrestler. Nice enough when he was sober. Never hurt anybody on purpose. Queer as Aunt Millie's underwear, said Frank. You found that out, said Big Bob? And Frank shrugged. Big Bob said, then they decided to pair me off with the Kraut. This guy would come down the aisle wearing a Kaiser Wilhelm helmet and the spike on top, and everyone would go crazy booing him. He was a nasty bastard. The idea in wrestling is you don't hurt the other guy, you just make it look like you do. And you get along because you're in the ring together maybe 12 times a week. The script was, I fight him clean with these all-American moves I'm supposed to know from college, and he'd strangle me with a chain he hid from the ref, all part of the act. Maybe because the crowd's throwing chairs at him, he hated me. At least once every match, he didn't pull a punch. Stepped on my foot, name it. You should have told me. I could have taken care of him, said Frank. Big Bob didn't even seem to hear. The guy managing the tours were calling New York, telling to put one of us on tour somewhere else. But the German and me were the draw, so they didn't. One night in Youngstown, out in Ohio, he had twisted my shoulder the night before, and the ref had us together in the center of the ring, telling us he wants a fair fight, and all this, like it's a sporting event. I did some place kicking in college, so I took a step back, and booted the crowd right in the nuts. The crowd went crazy. His face turned purple, color I'd never seen anyone get, and I thought I'd killed him. But after a minute, the color faded, his eyes were shining, he smiled this insane smile, and said, "It nine hurt," and came after me. I tried to get out of the ring, but he shoved me over the ropes. The customers scattered, and I fell on some chairs and broke my arm. "But you heal fast," said Frank. "Pretty soon we found work in the American labor movement." Big Bob said, "They needed young guys not afraid to take action against the enemies of the working man. After that, we found ourselves in the Second War to end all wars. It was like going to confession. We came out of that with our sins forgiven." "We was heroes," said Frank. We looked at Bobby, then at me. "Some stuff you do early just gets classed as useful and youthful indiscretion. Other stuff sticks to you forever." "Like a rap sheet," said Frank. "Like membership in the Communist Party," said Bob. "Or having too many friends like that." All I knew was this was aimed at my father and me, and I wanted to get away from them. "I got something I need to talk to you about," Frank told his little brother. Bobby took that as the moment for us to escape to Benzedrine in a dirty movie. Early that summer, Uncle Frank Mahoney, all sunburned and screwed out of his head, gave us a ride and told a story. "I was at Revere Beach, and in this bar on the shore was a girl. Seemed nice, friendly, you know. Nice clothes. I buy her a few drinks and a few more. We go in the water, wading out. We're in over our waists, and I start getting friendly. She gets kind of shy. I'm feeling her up. Yes? When we get away from Uncle Frank, I ask Bobby, 'What was all that?' 'He thinks we're queers,' Bobby said. Get away. I remembered my first day at my high school. Some tension and same tension. We're in jail that time in our 20s. I remembered my first day at my high school. Some tension and same tension and setup. But even at age 14, I knew enough to make friends with Bobby Mahoney, the toughest guy in the cell block. Pretty soon, Bobby shared his speed and beer. A few times, we did a little clockwork, but mostly he was scared people would find out. That summer, Bobby graduated from high school. They had him in prep school, getting ready for college. After the car ride with his uncle, he was busy and distant. My friend Joey is amused. "That time we got busted with the dope and it took my family a while to bail us out, I knew you were sizing up the guys, and I started wondering who'd be my daddy. But when he sees I'm not laughing, he asks, 'Did you and Bobby ever get together again?' And I love how quickly the straight guy understands. I looked him up a few times, a few years ago. Turns out we were both outsiders. He's on the HIV cocktail, living in the Boston suburbs with a partner. We could talk whenever we want, but we don't somehow. I'm still thinking about this a bit later when Lois asks, 'So, if it wasn't the uniforms, what was all that stuff with the firemen and the cops about?' And I tell her. They were secret societies. Boston was a small enough place, and Irish enough, that a kid in trouble with the law who had a relative on the force could tell the cops that, and if it checked out, they'd let him go. Of course, they'd contact the relative, give him the information. He'd decide what to do with it. The summer before my senior year of high school, I lost a friend named Bobby and acquired new ones and got busted in a gay bar. The cops smacked me around, but I gave them Uncle Bill's name, and they let me go. I was a bloody mess when I come home. My parents went crazy and practically locked me in the house, but I never told them the truth. Uncle Bob took me aside at the next family gathering, said I needed to think how hurt my parents would be if they knew. He told me not to let it happen again. I noticed he was careful not to touch me. My parents didn't find out, but if they'd had doubts Boston wasn't my town, this killed them. That spring, many months after the bar raid, I came home one night, well past my curfew, a bit screwed up, and expecting trouble. The house was the one I thought of as dark and miserable. My father was waiting for me, as pissed off as always. The unions had already been voted down. Now, he told me he'd been denied a raise and would have to look for a teaching job elsewhere. We'd have to move. It's like a door got slammed in my face, my father said. I remembered long before hearing one teacher ask another why my old man didn't understand that trying to organize was going to get him ridden out of town. That fall, the family moved to New York suburbs. Eventually, they moved back to the Boston suburbs. But by then, I was living in Manhattan. My father was an editor. Later, he and my mother wrote textbooks, did well. At my father's funeral, I thought about Big Bob and Uncle Frank, the teachers and Uncle Bill the cop, all the ones who couldn't understand why we didn't understand we were misfits. By the time he died, their Boston was gone, bulldozed, gentrified. The Irish replaced by new immigrants, Lois said, and none but the misfits survived.
Version of the song Come Take a Trip on My Airship, and Rick is saying, oh, that's a song from 1911, Irish Boston. I'm going, oh yeah, right, I looked it up. You can come take a trip on the airship. That is WBAI in New York City. Listener-sponsored, non-commercial. Is that a stretch? Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. This program is called Hour of the Wolf. I am called Jim Freund. With me...
That's even your name.
It happens the fact to be. Yeah, I'm not only called that, but it happens to be my name. And the name of my guest is Richard Bose, or Rick Bose. Right, reading for a change, something that isn't overtly fantasy or science fiction.
Not speculative fiction, no. It's really, I think I've written two stories in my entire career writing stories that weren't spec fiction of some kind.
And yeah, but they're wonderful. They're utterly wonderful.
Why, thank you.
Have you heard of a movie called Stories We Tell? I've not yet seen this movie, but it's got me very interested.
I haven't either. And yes, it's a movie about stories, basically.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's a movie that I adore and love, the Terry Gilliam's version of Baron Munchausen.
Oh, jeez.
Has the little girl in it, Sarah Polley.
Right.
And Sarah Pauly has, you know, grown up to be a director and writer and actress and a lot of things, many of which I don't see because some of them are overt horror films, right, although I understand good ones. And she made an allegedly nonfiction film about her father. Both she and her father were, her father was in all three seasons of a wonderful Canadian TV series called Slings and Arrows, which I know I once tried to turn you on to, Rick. Did you ever see it?
No, I did not.
You would like it a lot. But at any rate, very Canadian show. But Sarah Pauly was in it for one season, and her father for all three, as a matter of fact, playing, you know, a gay old gent and his partner, they play the piano and sing in and out the songs. It's about a Shakespeare company in like New Brundage.
A provincial Canadian show.
Well, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah, well, I certainly remember provincial companies from my childhood. Yeah.
Each season of the series, there were three seasons of Slings and Arrows, is a different play. So one season is Hamlet, the second Macbeth, and the third, of course, Lear. Has to be. And so Sarah Pauly made a movie about her father. Remember, she was in this TV show, as was her father. And I haven't seen it yet. It was nominated, by the way, for an Academy Award for nonfiction film, a long form. But I saw reviews that alleged that some of it may not all be exactly nonfiction. That some of it may be performed and acting and stories. The name of the movie is Stories We Tell. And, of course,
it's the line between, I mean, this.
Now, you're writing actual nonfiction, changing the names.
Pretty much. I did change names, and actual circumstances never as neat as it needs to be. But yeah, pretty much this is all stuff that happened, and people are the people. But if you're talking about the life, especially of an actor, then you're talking basically about something. You're dealing with non-reality, you're dealing with plays, you're dealing with movies, you're dealing with whatever it was he was doing. And I'm not sure that, you know, isn't sort of endemic to the form.
I haven't seen the movie.
If it's a movie that's got Hamlet in it, then you've got something.
Well,
that
the TV
real.
Series did.
Right.
The TV series did, and that's pure fiction.
Right.
There's no question about that. And they don't even know each other in the TV series.
Right.
But this is a documentary film. But the point is that there may be a certain amount of. It was implied in reviews I read, I could be wrong, that there was a certain amount of, shall we say, meta within the scope
of
this story. I never met an actor. The idea being that there are stories told about her father and acted out within the movie that may in fact be totally performance.
Just made up. Well, the stories...
I don't know this to be... Again, I haven't seen the film yet.
The stories that you make up are always more apropos than the stories that actually happened. I mean...
They are, yeah.
You know, real life, you can't... I mean, even in this thing, there had to be some juggling of time. But all of that, including the preposterous... I won't give his actual name. head of the Boston Labor Union. I mean, he was real. That conversation is real. That brother was real. And he told us the story of, you know, his boxing, his wrestling.
His
career.
Wrestling, yeah.
And, yeah.
I knew a wrestler. Big name. I don't remember his big name. But Max Schmid of WBAI, who's a wrestling fan, I was working at a talent agency, and he was one of our clients, because wrestling, after all, is generally performance.
Well, also, it's And if you were injured in wrestling, it's workman's compensation.
That's no doubt.
It's no doubt. You know, you're injured playing baseball, then the team doctor has to take care of you. But if you're injured in wrestling, then United States takes care of you.
So I mentioned this guy's name in passing to Max. He says, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, yeah, well, we had lunch today, yeah. You know, nice guy. Very interesting people, wrestlers.
Well, they were all kinds.
I can't watch it, but...
Well, it's... What is to watch? I mean, it's all sort of... I remember, it was with the guy who shows up, the straight friend who I talked to at one point in this. It is that guy. He was staying in my apartment when I lived over on 2nd Avenue, and it was Saturday morning, and television was on, and it was wrestling. And it was... This Russian was the villain. The good guy was an American.
I'm going to say this had to be Channel 9, either 5 or 9.
I would assume, yeah.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
and the Russian guy was very came and row, and he pulled all sorts of dirty stuff. The audience was booing him. They hated him. He said, thank you for your greeting, and now I will sing a song of my country. And he sang in this beautiful voice,
no doubt,
the Russian folk song "To the Sparrow Hills," which I think was the national anthem of Russia
at some point, but the voice
was lovely, and the audience.
By the way, be careful when your hand hits that table;
it sounds like thunder.
Oh, wonderful
thunder!
Yeah,
people
yeah.
go deaf in New Jersey.
It's a whole Loki thing going on. Yeah,
but yeah, the thing about it was the voice. The audience didn't care; they threw things at him.
It's just, yeah, that's the performance.
And that's when I remembered. That's when I remembered actually the thing with the labor union organizer.
Oh,
his real name I keep being about to give, and I won't give.
His name is Google.
His name is Google.
His name is Google.
I mean, his son is still alive, but.
And the son's name is Google as well.
Also,
it's
Google
amazing.
Yeah, Junior. Yeah. Google Junior.
Google Junior. Yeah. Yeah.
The thing that's weird is, I mean, the son is gayer than Aunt Millie's underwear.
but he
looks exactly like his father.
You don't escape this.
You know, you don't get away.
We probably don't have enough time, speaking of Aunt Millie's underwear, where to discuss underwear this morning.
Well, the underwear, that's a different story.
The underwear collector. That's another show. I heard you tell that story as in stories.
That's only one part of the story.
I heard you tell a part of the story to Sidney Smith. And
Most of it isn't funny.
A lot of it wasn't funny, but nevertheless, you hit certain things where he was either howling in pain or in laughter, going a little bit between the two, I think.
Well, that's a story that was in a book of Queering Poe stories. I mean, believe me, Queering Edgar Allan Poe, it's a very short walk.
Yeah.
I mean, I think he was straight, but I mean, he was just very strange. Anyway.
I think it's safe to say that he was a queer gent in the old sense of the word.
Right. But I did a story called 7 Days of Poe, and it's me. And I read Poe originally. I was working in the Boston Public Library, and we were fairly unsupervised. And I was up in the stacks, and I sat there under a skylight reading Edgar Allan Poe stories. And in the story, it's 7 events from my life that tie in with Edgar Allan Poe stories, and one of them is The Underwear Collector.
Oh, God.
And sometime I'll read that.
Yeah, I would like that. I would like that a lot.
I mean, I had to take out a lot of the forbidden words for this story.
Missed one, but...
did I? Which one did
I? Number 2, I think. Where's the sign? I think it's number 2 that you included. You didn't...
No, don't hold it still here.
Yes, I didn't know that was forbidden.
I could have.
That's the first of them. But you know, actually, we're in safe harbor, and it's but it's something we try. The delay wasn't turned on. It is now.
Well,
because
you know,
I don't know what the bleep I'm going to say next. So
the thing I forget the guy's name. He's a very distinguished American actor. He was played the bartender in some show that was set in Alaska for years, and he'd been around for a long time, and he was the star of the musical Urinetown. Mm-hmm. And he was interviewed on NPR, and he was so proper, such a nice, proper old gentleman, that he couldn't actually say the word urine on the radio.
Yeah.
And the young interviewer, the woman who was interviewing, was happy to provide
the show was a hard sell for the PR people, and I understand that it sort of, we'll use the word again, queered the movie deal.
Well, one of the things...
I don't know why, because actually that kind of thing, it, you know, goes easier in cinema than it does. But I still think, you know, it's the big ads that they would have put out on the New York Times. Yes.
Well, it was a hit. I mean, it was a successful show.
It ran
show.
For years.
Well,
I never saw it.
It closed because part of the gimmick of the thing was that it was that theater, and I forget the name of it, that was way east of Broadway. I think it was almost on Fifth Avenue.
Mm.
And it was not maintained. It was falling apart.
Was it the Hudson Theater?
We're not going to be able to get that name out of me.
Okay.
It was a famous name, but it was way over there. And it was not maintained, so you went up these stairs that looked like they were going to fall down. And eventually, the theater reached the point where it was condemned, and that's why the show all was going to be torn down. And that's why the show left. And they could have gone on. But yeah, I do remember that. He just could not do it.
Yeah.
He could not.
We have about 6 minutes left, believe it or not.
Of the show? Or
yeah,
of
the show. Of the show. And then Lister comes on the air with Burn Baby Burn Clappers. But I would like... do you want to...
open up the airwaves?
Yeah, open up the airwaves to listeners if we have...
If we have a listener.
Any erudite... folk at 212-209-2900. Now you know who the first caller will be. Even you know, even if I chose at random, there's no avoiding. I might as well just say good morning, hit the button and say good morning, Robert.
Good morning, James.
Yes. Hey Robert,
good morning,
how are you doing?
Rick. First of all, Rick, you know that to the Sparrow Hills, very famous Russian folk song. In fact, it, along with Meadowlands, a.k.a. Polyushka, were the two unofficial anthems for the partisans.
Yes, I did know
in
that.
In 41, 42, 43.
You're going to find there's very little here that Rick doesn't know.
No. I know. But I got to ask you, James, was that a calliope, or was that the merry-go-round in Prospect Park?
All I can tell you was that it was credited to somebody named Paul Euler. E-U-L-E-R. I use a streaming music service legally. You know, we pay the royalties, and I pay for the streaming rights, and I was actually trying to find the 1911 version of that song, but I came up with that one instead. Because I was searching while Rick was writing.
That was lovely, though. I felt I was riding the merry-go-round in Prospect Park all over again. Rick, I got to tell you, when your Queen Camber and seven others came out, I said... to you and others, unequivocally, it's your best book to date, and nothing has changed my mind on that one.
Oh, thank you.
Hope that someday, and I said it to two conferences in Canada and London on fairy tales I attended, and several people borrowed the book because I took it with me, and I bandied it all over the place.
Why, thank you.
And about 20 people said they read it. I said, you got to give it back to me, or else I come after you with a saw.
Next time, make them buy a copy.
Well, I told them. I gave them your email and everything.
It's sold. No, don't do
you
that.
You can buy it.
There are places like Barnes & Noble and Amazon and Powell's Books.
Well, I checked a couple
of books. Unless it's Hachette, there's no problem buying it.
I hope, by the way, Rick, that you will consider doing a second volume at some point. Now, I want to ask you about the Abbott and Costello reference. What year was that again?
That I was watching that on television? 53.
53. That bald-headed landlord's name was Sidney Field.
I know.
And that was the that was the episode where we took mathematics to a new art form. Because
writing the numbers on the wall.
7 times 13 was 28.
I knew his name. I wasn't, I mean, my parents were in the business.
Names have been changed to protect the
All the names
guilty.
Have changed in that for various reasons. I don't think that there was anything particularly...
It's like Fargo, you know.
I always wondered whether names like Mike the Cop, Mr. Buzzicaloo, Hillary Brooke were real, or whether they were, you know, sort of stage names or, you know, names of actors.
Those were names for that show that actors took. Remember that Abbott and Costello came out of burlesque.
I know, yes.
And that was a thing in burlesque that people did not necessarily use their own name. I mean, Pinky Lee's name wasn't Pinky Lee.
You're kidding me.
No,
it's not that I've broken,
broken
your heart.
Broken. Oh, my God.
I've shattered your childhood. Yeah.
There we go.
But I took pleasure in it. So you've made me happy.
Robert, we're going to have to wrap up here because I need Rick to recite his books in print.
Okay.
And that's going to take a couple of minutes.
All right.
Oddly enough.
Good luck, Rick.
Thank you.
Okay. Guess what? Books in print. Tell us what people can buy or read online of your work.
Online, on my website, there are a couple of stories that...
We actually have another phone call coming in, but...
Oh.
You want to take a chance?
Yeah, let's take a chance.
Okay, it has to be real quick, though. Hi, you're on the air. Hello. Hello, your feedback. I'm sorry.
Many people have feedback.
Okay,
it said takes nothing away.
Try that one again. Hi, you're on the air. Hello.
Oh, it's a ghost. So many of my
friends. Yeah, we're short on time. I'm afraid. So, you know what it is when people are listening and it's on delay. They're listening to their radios rather than their phone.
Right.
And they don't realize. But now we've got 2 minutes left.
Well. The books that I put out last year were Dust Devil and a Quiet Street, which was a Lambda Award nominee and is a novel.
And although it starts out, the first chapter of the novel is a favorite here at WBAI.
It is. There's a Hole in the City, yes. And then so it's Dust Devil and a Quiet Street, and certainly get that at Amazon or any place else. And there are two collections of short stories. One is a collection... very short collection of fairy tales, The Queen, The Cambion, and Seven Others, which
Cambion
is...
Cambion being C-A-M-B-I-O-N.
Right. It's the child of a human and a demon who's called a Cambion. Merlin is a Cambion. His mother is a nun, and his father is a demon. It's, you know, it's the kind of marriage that really doesn't work. I don't know why. But anyway, there's that, the Queen and the Cambion. And then there is another collection, If Angels Fight. Now, earlier stuff is still available. Minions of the Moon...
Came back into print.
The older version is around. This Minions of the Moon has... an additional story.
New Kevin Grierson story.
Yes,
yeah.
Right.
Just to get you.
Yes. I wish it had worked better, but yes. And then there is the time from the files of the Time Rangers. Those are all available.
Yeah, and I don't know which I would recommend first because they are of such different. Feels they if you want the fairy tales, there's the Queen and the Cambion. If you if you want the more overtly connected gay Lambda story stuff,
Lambda-esque.
There we go, new word, Lambda-esque material, that would be the Kevin Grierson Minions of the Moon, I dare say.
And if you want some more of it, then you get Dust Devil and a Quiet Street.
Exactly. Which is just a brilliant, brilliant collection of novel collection, I think is a good way to put it. They're all good. Fix up, whatever.
Fix up, we call it up.
Yeah,
fix
Raymond up. Chandler would never have accepted that, although he did it all the time. And Cage Baker never would admit to that term, and I know damn well that's exactly what she did.
Well, Cage was very nice to me. Cage was very nice to me.
Cage was wonderful. At any rate, Thank you, Rick, for being here.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Always open to you. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you for listening. Rich, visit me at OurWolf.com or on Facebook. You can join the group. Visit Rick at Richard Bowes.
Rick Bowes.
Rick Bowes.
RickBowes.com.
I bought that myself.
And visit me on Facebook, but visit me at Amazon and buy some books.
Oh, yeah, most importantly, visit him in your bookstore.
At your local bookstore, yes.
Thank you all for listening. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister. WBAI is back for a little while. Take care. Have a good morning.
Talking about Peru, Azania. Boston, Belfast, and forget Korea, Beirut, and forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talk about uptown Harlem, New York City, y'all, and Nicaragua. East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy. Never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
Thinking they slick, contradicting their own, taking me for a fool. They sent my man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he brought in the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn. What? Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home of the brave, land of the free. Boom! This is the home of the slave. Now hold on, just a mother. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why the wanna stole me when I tossed the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
After 3 o'clock, Mr. Back on the radio right here. Burning the imperialist flag, red, white, and blue.
Remember when you tried to lead up on the Japan? Cook them, I tell on a heat and unite. From the Babylon, start the ganja fight and bring in the big coke pipe. Coke it, we are going to pop them one by one. Y'all and boy, flap them two by two. Y'all and boy, beat them three by three. Y'all and boy, dust them four by four. Papi say no coke, get y'all come through me door. Whether him rich or whether him poor. Send back the smuggler to El Salvador. Tell them we no want them from we see shore. See the coke, get them, me a go back them for four. When me back them, is like them gone for tour. Make them know, say, I am nice or poor. Right, y'all know, jam and them can't come through me door. Me will beat them one by one. Y'all and boy, with them two by two. Y'all and boy, with them three by three. Lord, we a go flap them four by four. Now remember when you trade them with a budding ganja pipe. Cook them, I tell, and I eat and unite. Just the other day, one liver gets the foot. The man will get the money, him don't want split up. Two degree, the business man get missed up. Then the family and friends are fair set up. And they want the youth, them do this silly fuck. Remember when they tread them, did the pudding ganja fight. Cook them, I tell, and I heat and unite. From the Babylon, the big ganja fight. I'm bringing the big coke pipe. Watch a man a piece, cut up and chop up and mash up and shut up. Jail load full up and prison get packed up. You know what they, some of them a think corrupt. But deal with the coke. Some sell them out, some life get mashed up. 80 a ball, say no money now come up. I said that true, and wifey get gone up. Bad man, brother from country, he ma come up. 80 a run through some bush and borrow. Wifey bread, that's why she must get blood up. Anytime he more large, she must get stabbed up. 80 friend of height, she no want get blend up. No want in a nothing, she no want get tie up. She nervous, she nervous, she nervous, she nervous. Start to get hot like something in a thermos. Tomorrow fly, it's bread, she famous. Remember when you tread them, did a budding ganja pipe. Hook them, I
defending and bending the rules, we apprehend and now we send them away. Shout out to the rhythm, don't keep sleeping, be the new song, DJ, give it another play. Ready now, we prepare for action, new version, we'll catch and you can't escape. So feed the spirit chanting, give thanks, put your hands up and dance, because dancing is free. Explode in the thunder. Someone they criticize, but they don't listen now. How we make the vision amplify when we move a crowd. Visions with rhythms in the sky, deep and spiritual. Sound baby, you're connected by the soul and physical. Prisons reaching in into our minds, we can analytical. We bring a fire, gonna set the free today. So come on, we amplify the sounds of reality.
Build up the fire, make it amplify.